Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby Podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by trichologist Claire Fulham, chatting all things hair loss.
I remember then going, I'm losing a bit more hair. Like, I could see hair everywhere. It was all over my desk and work everywhere. And so I went to my GP. She found five big patches on my scalp, one the size of my fist. So I was like, right, what am I going to do about this? Give me a plan. She just looked me dead in the eye and said, there's nothing you can do. I went on list for dermatologists. She had a cancellation and she very quickly said, yes, you have alopecia areata.
As ever, available on all podcast platforms.
Before we get into this podcast, please be aware that this episode contains graphic details of murder that some people may find distressing. Today on the Indo Daily, the murder of Aisling Murphy and how Yosef Pushka tried to get away with it.
23-year-old primary school teacher was killed on the banks of the Grand Canal outside Tullamore last Wednesday. It's thought she was out exercising when she was attacked.
Aisling epitomised the beauty of life, shared her passion, gifts and talents with others so generously. We pray for her friends, colleagues and students. May Aisling's legacy live in the hearts of all she touched. Lord, hear us.
Lord, graciously hear us.
When schoolteacher Aisling Murphy was brutally killed in broad daylight, it sent shockwaves across the nation.
I think men need to listen more to women. We need to listen more to what women are saying to us. And sometimes we don't do that good in a good enough fashion.
I want to be able to go on a jog at 4 p.m, or even at 10 at night, or midnight, or 3 a.m, or whatever, like to do, just to be able to live without worrying that some man is going to come along and like end my life.
Today, Yosef Pushka was found guilty of her murder in Tullamore in January 2022. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Catherine Fegan and Emer Cotter of the Irish Independent, who have both covered the case extensively, to tell the story of the Aisling Murphy trial. Catherine, can you take us back to early in 2022, and news broke of a murder in Tullamore in County Offaly?
Yes, it was January 2022. It was a Wednesday. A press release came in from the Gardaí just before 7 o'clock about a serious assault on the Grand Canal Way in Tullamore, County Offaly. That was all the details that we had. And then less than an hour later, another Garda press release saying that this was a fatal assault, that a woman in her 20s had died, and that a man in his 40s had been arrested, that the scene had been preserved, and an investigation was now opened, a murder investigation. But I was working from home that day, and straight away, this was a really, really big story. It was all over social media that this had happened. All the crime journalists were ringing the guards to try and get details. It was a real frenzy to try and get details on who this was. And very, very quickly it emerged that it was a young woman, Aisling Murphy, a primary school teacher from Tullamore in County Offaly. She'd been teaching in Durrow Primary School. She'd finished school that day and she'd gone for a walk on the Grand Canal Way in Tullamore. And she'd met a lone attacker. The guards described him as a lone attacker on that day. And she had been fatally assaulted and was dead.
To say it sent shockwaves across the nation would almost be an understatement. It was almost a moment over the following 48 hours where people, there was a groundswell of emotion around her death.
Yeah, I think everybody will remember the reaction to this because it was so widespread. a lot of emotion, national outpouring, like you say, the details of it, of this scene of this young girl on a very public walkway. Like, I've been down there at the Grand Canal Way in Tullamore. It's a very open area, and the locals are very proud of it. A lot of people had used it during the pandemic to exercise. Very busy area. It was considered a very safe place to exercise. We had this young girl out. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was still bright. She's out there. Like I say, it was very busy. Some stranger emerges from the darkness and kills her in broad daylight.
Yeah, so it was kind of, it wasn't dark, lonely corner of Dublin city centre late at night in a rough parathon or anything like that. This was very much middle of Ireland, well-known town, very public location, stranger attacking a young woman.
Yeah, I remember going down to the scene the next day. The first place I went to was the scene. I stood at Digby Bridge and looked down. You could see the crime scene tent was on the tarmac side of the path. Really open space, no obvious places to hide. Looked very, very safe. No corners, or it just looked like somewhere that something like this would never happen. And there was a lot of people at the scene at that time. That was the next day, and people who used it all the time were down gathering, and they had said that they just couldn't believe that this had happened at this particular site. People had walked along this at night, even they felt it was so safe.
We have lost a dear colleague and a friend in our school. Aisling was a shining light in our school. She lit up the corridors. The pupils' faces were gleaming every day they saw her. An extraordinary, fantastic human being.
There's a lot of shock about that. And then this all came on the back of the Sarah Everard murder in the UK, and this idea that women, you know, should be able to go out and walk on their own and not be attacked. But this would never happen in Ireland. This doesn't happen here. And all of a sudden we're faced with this reality. Well, it has happened here.
And there was a vigil at that bridge, as you recall, for Aisling. Family members attended it and they played music, and it was a remarkable moment.
They just kept coming, hundreds of people filling the streets around the Irish Parliament in Dublin. At vigils nationwide, they paused to express their shock and anger at the murder of Aisling Murphy.
Yeah, it was a really poignant scene. That was the Friday night. Very quickly after the murder, Aisling's photo was everywhere. Face was everywhere on social media and all the newspapers, on the TV. Everybody was talking about this case.
And a picture was developing of her as well.
Yeah, she was 23, primary school teacher. Like I say, came from quite a small family, and she came from Blue Ball, just outside Tullamore. She had an older sister and an older brother, and her family were steeped in this music tradition. Her father played the banjo. She was a very talented fiddle player, and she played a tin whistle. Her sister played the button accordion. They were really involved in this traditional music scene, very well known locally. She was also a very keen sportswoman. She played for the Camogie team. She tutored music, so she knew a lot of young people in the area. And then she was a teacher, so she had, she had a lot of pupils, and she knew a lot of staff in the school. Just a really accomplished person who was very, very well known, very well liked. And like you said, this picture started to emerge, and I think everybody could connect with various bits of her personality. Everybody knew an Aisling or somebody like an Aisling. And there was just so much emotion connected to what had happened to her, both locally and nationally, that this groundswell just emerged. She was literally everywhere. And like you said, these vigils started to be planned, you know, all over Ireland. There were vigils in York, in London, everywhere. And then on the Friday night, the focal point of the vigil was in the main town in Tullamore. But there was a separate vigil at Digby Bridge, which her parents, like you say, attended. Her sister was there, her brother was there, and her boyfriend was there. And they made this very solemn pilgrimage as such along the canal way opposite the crime scene, because they couldn't walk down the path, and they all linked arms and walked down. Everybody was watching. It was a very sad scene. Walked down and walked back, and they came back to the car park there, and the priest said a few words, and her father played her favourite song, which was Sweet 16. It was very, very, very sad.
The crime, I think, has also asked questions of ourselves and of our society. It has questioned our attitudes, and particularly our attitudes towards women, and it has questioned, too, our values and our morality.
The Gardaí had got a man, though. There was no manhunt because they had got the suspect straight away.
Straight away, and it was in that second press release. We have a man in custody. He's in his 40s, and he's being questioned, you know, by Gardaí. And when I went down there on the 13th, all the locals knew that somebody had been arrested for this. They knew who it was. They were talking about this person. They knew where he lived. They knew his family. And there was a sense that, yes, this awful thing has happened. It's awful. This girl's been brutally killed. But the man who did it has been caught, he's been apprehended, so we can move on. And then on the Thursday night, another Garda press release, this man has been released without charge.
Police released their first suspect, sparking renewed fear, but later said they were making significant progress.
There are huge parallels between this and the murder of Sarah Everard last year. It's a young woman out on her own. Except that this happened in the middle of the day. It could have been anybody.
He had been wrongly ID'd in an ID parade. It wasn't him. By that stage, they had fingerprint evidence from the saddle of the bike that was found at the scene, and they had DNA evidence, and they realised it didn't match this particular individual, so he was released and let go. And the vigil was taking place in Tullamore the next day, all these vigils. And I can remember at that time that there was an awful lot of anger over the fact that now we have somebody still on the loose. Like, where is this man? Is he still here? Is he going to strike again? People were, you know, the sadness and grief was moving towards anger, and people were, like, very, very frightened.
So you basically had a manhunt centering around Tullamore, but meanwhile, Emer, it was actually above in Blanchardstown Hospital in Dublin that there was a development.
Yes, there had been a completely unrelated stabbing in Blanchardstown the previous night, and the guards were aware of two people, and then they became aware of a possible third victim. So they went to St. James Hospital to speak to Joseph Pushka as a potential victim of a crime. One of the first things that both Garda Conor Newman and Sergeant Paul MacDonald, what they both noted was the marks, the scratches on his hands and on his forehead. And when they spoke to Pushka, Prosecution Counsel Amory Lawler, in her closing speech, called it a cock and bull story. But he told them that he had gotten a taxi from Houston Station to out to Blanchardstown, where he hoped to meet a woman, and that he literally had arrived there, gotten out of the taxi, and he was immediately assaulted by two men. What the guards later said was that the story, there was a lot of holes in the story. He wasn't able to tell them where it happened. He wasn't able to give a description of the alleged assailants. He didn't have any details of the woman that he was supposed to meet. They were suspicious, and they went back to their inspector, Shane McCartan, and they spoke to him. And they knew Pushka was from Tullamore. And they just got this sense that the story didn't add up. It didn't make sense. So they decided to contact their colleagues in Tullamore. And it basically was that conversation that led to everything that has happened since.
Pushka is basically, he's arrested and charged. And then we're back to Tullamore because the charges take place on a very heated night down in Tullamore at the district court there.
Joseph Pushka was officially charged on the 19th of January. So he's taken to Tullamore District Court. There's a lot of tension building in the interim. You know, we have Aisling's murder. Her funeral had taken place. Very sad. And we had this initial suspect who was arrested and released. And then we have this new suspect. Social media was described as quite ugly in court by Michael Bowman at that time. He was saying that there was a real sense of hysteria being whipped up on social media in and around Tullamore about what was happening, who was being arrested, who might have done this. There was a lot of tension rising, and this culminated in the crowd that had gathered outside Tullamore District Court that night. It was a special sitting for him to be charged. And there was a lot of video that emerged of that, if you recall at the time, and the crowds that were outside. I remember the prison van that took Pushka to court that evening. They had surrounded it. It looked like at least 100 people had gathered. They were angry. They were shouting various things at him. He was taken out. He had his mask on. We're still in COVID times. He had the mask on, and he's taken out. It just looked like an angry. It was like a lynch mob had descended. Real palpable sense of anger and huge crowds of people just shouting abuse. It looked like a very sort of dangerous situation that evening.
So he's charged with murder on that occasion, and then the case is basically prepared against them. So we are effectively then moving forward to October of 2023. The case is moved to the Central Criminal Court, Eimear, and yet I have to say there was a string of evidence and witnesses brought forward. Two people that stood out were two joggers who were also along the canal that day.
It's funny though how Catherine talks about all the emotion that was around that time of the vigil. When it came to the court, that was the one thing that the judge, the prosecution, that, you know, everyone said this, there is no emotion in a court. It has to be, any findings of guilt or innocence has to be based on evidence, and there can be no emotion, no sympathy either for Aisling or for Joseph Pushka either in a decision that is made by the jury. So it's interesting that there was so much emotion around it, and now suddenly we're at the stage where there's absolutely no emotion, and that can be very hard for the family to hear, because suddenly Aisling is evidence in a trial against somebody, you know. So in relation to Jenna Stack and Aoife Maren, they were the two joggers. They were actually both teachers as well. And they'd gone for a run, and Jenna saw a bike in the undergrowth. And she kind of thought it was just a bit weird. And literally that's where it started from. She was like, what's a bike doing there? And she's thinking, that looks like a nice bike. That's a weird place for a bike. And she looks at it and she says it to Aoife. And then they hear rustling. And they knew it wasn't from an animal. You know, that it definitely wasn't that kind of rustling. So they looked, and one of them went, you know, hello, is everything okay down there? And when Jenna moved down a little bit, and that's when she said that she saw this man on top of who we now know was Aisling Murphy. And she said she couldn't see her, she could see her legs, and Pushka was crouched over her. And she said Aisling was kicking really, really hard, that she was using her core. She was trying to do her best to escape. And when she saw what was happening, they immediately ran to get help.
Help arrives, but unfortunately it is too late. What do we learn about how Aisling Murphy died?
We learned that Aisling Murphy was stabbed 11 times to the right side of her neck. The stab wounds would have cut her voice box, her artery, her left and right carotid, and her jugular vein. So really, when that happened, she didn't stand a chance.
There's a string of other witnesses who were there at the scene on the day, but there's also forensic and DNA evidence.
Yes, some of the DNA evidence proved to be crucial in this murder investigation. First, the bike that was found on the scene, Joseph Pushka's fingerprint and his DNA were found on it. Now, he tried to explain that away by saying he had been at the scene, he had been trying to help Aisling, and he wasn't the killer. So that was how he was explaining that his bike was at the scene, and so therefore it wasn't unusual that his DNA would have been on his bike. They also found a male DNA sample underneath Aisling Murphy's fingernails. So this is what happens with this. This is when all the female DNA is excluded, and it's just they just focus on the male DNA, and they discovered that was linked also to Joseph Pushka. So these scratches on the under her fingernails, it's not something that would have come from casual contact or passing each other. This would have had to have been close contact. And basically what Anne-Marie Lawler said was that she scratched him. She was scratching, she was fighting for her life, and she became her own investigator in her own murder. That's what she said in her closing speech. So Aisling helped to catch her killer ultimately.
Catherine, we've got this contradictory evidence then directly from Bushka himself. Tell us about what he told Gardaí in the initial interviews back in the middle of January, when they interviewed him during that period when he was in the hospital.
After the contact with Gardaí and Tullamore, they dispatched two of their own to go down and to see Bushka. And during the first interaction with him, he's taken into a side room so they can speak to him. And they have an interpreter on the phone to interpret. His native language is Slovakian. So that first interview is to do with, you know, what happened to you? How'd you get these injuries? And he tells them this story about this these two assailants in Blanchardstown coming out of nowhere and stabbing him and all of this. And so they leave it at that, and they leave him, they go away. And in the meantime, they've got to get a warrant for the hospital to get his clothes, his phone, whatever items they wanted to seize. And they come back later that evening, and they speak to Josef Bushka again. He's in another private room at this stage. There's two Gardaí in the room with him. The interpreter's on the phone. And they're asking him questions, and they tell him, they explain the warrant to him, what the warrant's about. And at some point in the conversation, they say, well, it's in relation to a murder in Tullamore. And through his interpreter, he says,
Am I a suspect in this case?
And he's told, again through the interpreter, you're a person of interest. And we heard from the Gardaí who interviewed him, and we also heard from the interpreter in court. They all testified about what happened in this room, and they said that after that there was a pause, and Josef Bushka tells his interpreter that he wants to make a literal translation. You know, I want you to take me word for word now. I'm going to tell you something. I want it word for word, you to translate. And he says, you know, when these words are widely known at this stage, he says,
I did it. I'm the murderer.
So they get this admission from Josef Bushka about him. He's murdered Aisling Murphy. So they have this admission, and two of the Gardaí leave. Another guard comes in to stay with Bushka. And he continues to talk to him. I think it's a guard of Fergus Hogan was the name of this guard. He's in the room with Bushka after this initial admission. And he goes further. He says, you know,
I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do it. I cut her.
And he mentions that a knife that he had for the chain of his bike. At this stage of the game, the details of how Aisling Murphy hadn't been made public. It was done for operational reasons. The guards hadn't made that detail about her being stabbed or any sort of weapon being used. So that was a key detail. So they decided at that point that he shouldn't be questioned anymore without a solicitor, and the guards are instructed to leave him. So the next time that Josef Bushka is spoken to by guards is on the 18th of January when he's discharged, and that's when he was arrested in St James's Hospital and taken to Tullamore Garda Station, when again story changes.
Detectives investigating the murder of the 23-year-old primary school teacher last Wednesday have arrested a man in his 30s. He's currently being detained at Tullamore Garda Station under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act 1984.
That, then, Amor, the story changes, then continues on when he takes a stand, presenting himself as this good Samaritan figure who happened upon the scene.
Bushka took to the stand and he was led through his evidence by Michael Bowman, his defence counsel, who told him, this was your story to tell. I can't tell your story for you. This is your story. And he told this story of being on his bike on the canal, and an unidentified, I think somebody called it a COVID compliant killer, came along, pushed him off his bike, and then proceeded to stab him twice. And then Aisling Murphy came along and he saw her. He was stabbed a third time and he was lying there, and he was unclear as to how it happened. But when he looked up, he saw Aisling Murphy and this other COVID compliant killer in the bushes. He got up and he went over to them, and the killer went off, ran off. And that's when he saw that Aisling Murphy, he could see there was blood. He could see that there was wounds on her neck, and he picked up a scarf, or her scarf, and he put it over her, and he was trying to help her. And that's when he said that Jenna Stack, the jogger, came along, and what she thought was him hurting Aisling was actually him helping her.
There was one witness who raised question marks about Pushka's hospital confession as such. That was a consultant who raised issues about should he have been interviewed in the hospital.
Yes, this was Dr. Johan Grundling. He was a consultant, an emergency medicine and intensive care consultant who was based in the UK. And he has worked in the NHS, I think, for over 20 years. I suppose he raised a number of questions. I think that was probably as far as he could go in relation to Pushka's confession. He said that he was post-operative, so he just had surgery. He was in an unfamiliar environment. He didn't speak the language. And he was also on a strong painkiller called oxycodone. And he said that all these things together raised a doubt about Pushka's confession.
Nonetheless, the prosecution was having none of this.
No, they weren't. They called their own expert witness, Professor Michael Ryan, who's a world-renowned expert in toxicology. And he basically said that the amount of oxycodone in Pushka's system at the time that he made this confession was so small that it wouldn't have had any impact on him at all.
Catherine, another compelling witness was Anne-Marie Kelly. Who was she? What was her role here?
So Anne-Marie Kelly, she was another primary school teacher in this story, and she had come to give evidence of her interactions with Joseph Pushka on the 12th of January 2022. So she had headed off for a walk shortly before 2 o'clock on that day with her dog, little dog Joey. She set off and she's walking around Church Avenue in Tullamore, on her way to the Grand Canal Way. And she said that she felt like someone was behind her. She had this really uneasy feeling like somebody was behind her. And she realises there's a man behind her on a bicycle, cycling really close, really behind, makes her feel very uneasy. So much so that on two occasions, she tries to get him to pass her out. But she carries on regardless. She describes him, you know, she gives a description, foreign looking, is on the bike, dark eyes. It's Joseph Pushka, and he didn't deny that it was him, but he said he wasn't following her at all. And she gets to Digby Bridge and thinks that she's lost Pushka at that point and continues back to Tullamore. So she's walking back towards Tullamore after all of this really odd behaviour from this man. And she described passing various people on that walk back. She was asked about the last person that she passed on that route back to Tullamore. And she said she passed this really young girl. She said she was younger than her. And she actually lit up when she was talking about her. And you could tell, she didn't name the person, but everybody knew who she was talking about. And she said that they were talking about her dog, that the girl asked her about her dog, what breed he was, and that she was petting the dog. And she said she was really friendly and really smiley and just chatty and nice. And that was the last person that she passed that day. So that was Aisling Murphy. So she passes Aisling Murphy. Aisling's heading toward Digby Bridge, which we know she turned and walked back. And on her walk back, she met her killer. She met Joseph Pushka.
Eimear, ultimately, the prosecution wasn't accepting anything that Pushka was putting forward. What were the key points in summing up the case?
Well, Anne-Marie Lawler, in her closing, she said that Pushka pivoted between lying and not remembering. And she said some of the lies that he said were foul and contemptible. I suppose she started with a confession. And she said the confession was powerful evidence. And she said, you know, it might be blindingly obvious, but he said he did it because he did it. And I suppose that was her first point. And then she also mentioned the DNA evidence that was found. And she also mentioned Anne-Marie Kelly as well. But she said that she felt a little foolish, maybe, that she was engaging in this fantasy that Pushka had put, that Aisling Murphy had been killed by this 6-foot man in a COVID mask. And she said that, you know, the truth of the matter was the man who claimed he went to help her was the man who killed her. And that then what happened then was he went and stabbed himself. He tried to retrofit the stabbing into a story. And he told lies after lies after lies. Now, defence counsel Michael Bowman said that, you know, lying was not necessarily evidence of guilt. And he also reminded the jury that a second man had been arrested and then later cleared of any involvement in Aisling's murder. And it was a stark reminder to everyone that it was easy to become a suspect in a situation like this.
Eimear, you're covering a lot of these trials over time. Could Joseph Pushka have gotten away with it?
Well, now, that's the big question. Pushka wasn't known to the guards. He had no previous convictions. He had never come to their attention. He got away from the scene without being detected. I mean, flights from Dublin to Slovakia, I checked during the winter, they go on every Sunday on a Thursday. The murder happened on a Wednesday. In theory, Joseph Pushka could have been out of the country. Flight, I think it's only about €100, single flight to Bratislava at the moment. So he could have been gone. I suppose the funny thing is, but what actually alerted the Gardaí was Pushka stabbing himself. And if he hadn't gone if he hadn't been brought to St. James's Hospital, if he hadn't spun the story, which made no sense, the guards may have taken them much longer to have come to have identified him as a person of interest.
Catherine, will we ever have any satisfactory explanation of a motive here?
Well, the prosecution certainly didn't put forward a motive in this case. You know, he can speculate. Was he trying to, you know, rob her? Was there an attempted, you know, was there a sexual motive to this? There's no evidence of that either. And I think that's probably one of the most difficult things, maybe for the family in this, is that there is no answer as to why this happened. There was no connection between them either. That was set out from the start. These two people did not know each other. So it wasn't a case that there was any sort of, you know, there's no bad blood between them. They didn't know each other. And it's a random killing in broad daylight that nobody can make sense of. And we don't have a motive because, you know, there wasn't one established and it certainly wasn't put forward. So it's left hanging there. And I think that's the very scary thing about this. And the thing that has frightened everybody about this is that it could have happened to anybody. And unfortunately, it was a case of wrong place, wrong time.
She loved socialising and she never confined herself to any particular norm, but was a friend to all who had the pleasure of knowing her. She was everything you could hope for in the young woman, and she will never be out of our hearts. We will cherish her memory and keep alive her legacy and achievements in her short life.
And my thanks to Catherine Fegan and to Eimear Cotter. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of The Indo Daily was produced by Mary Carroll, researched by Dave Hanratty and Garrett Mulhall, with sound by John Smith. archive clips from RTE, Newstalk and the Irish Independent. And if you've been affected by this podcast, there are a list of helplines available by searching Someone to Talk To at the Irish Independent.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.